Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Lori Townsend.
Hello, welcome to Alaska Edition. I am Lori Townsend. Michael Carey will return next week. I'm your host this week. My guests are Greg Erickson. Greg, thanks for being with us. Greg is the editor of the Alaska Budget Report.
Editor at large.
Editor at large. That's right. I was going to make sure
They let me out of my cage.
And Ellen Lockyer is KSKA's Matsu, and you're reporter at large because you're covering areas outside of Anchorage.
Right, bouncing around Seward to Juneau to Wasilla.
Absolutely, all over the place. And Ed Ronco is joining us by Skype from Sitka. Ed is a reporter at KCAW in Sitka. Thank you so much, all of you, for joining us. There's been a lot of action in the legislature in the last couple of days, and we're going to be talking about that. But before we get to where that key legislation sits currently and in these final days, I want to talk about the continuing ripple effect of the sequestration cuts, the federal budget cuts. Military cuts mean that we've already seen that the red flag exercise will not be happening. Also, we've just learned that the biannual Northern Edge training exercise has been canceled for June. We were discussing before we went on air about some of the impacts to local economies, and more will be known about that as we go forward, and how that may impact the Anchorage economy to not have Northern Edge here. But sequestration has also hit the Indian Health Service, and Ed is with us to talk about some of the cuts that SEARCH, the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, is facing. Ed, they are looking at $3.5 million in cuts. What does this mean?
Well, they had just kind of dug out of a $4 million deficit when the sequestration hit. So this is an additional $3.5 million that they kind of fell back into the hole on. What it means tangibly is, and the biggest cut that they've announced so far, is that the Bill Brady Healing Center has closed, or will close, at the end of the month. It is a residential drug and alcohol treatment program, about 22 jobs, and certainly 50 or so patients a year affected by that decision.
Do they have a plan in place, or have you talked to anyone there that... Is there a plan to send patients who are in need of these services somewhere else, or how will they deal with that?
Patients who go to SEARCH for treatment for anything will still get treatment aside from the residential drug and alcohol treatment program. I haven't heard if SEARCH has a specific plan for patients who would have been affected. What they have done is, I believe this week or next, they're graduating the last class from the residential program, and then they're just not accepting new patients. So that's how they're transitioning out of it. There are other services here in Sitka, but certainly that is not the case in many of the smaller communities that SEARCH serves.
Well, I wanted to ask a bit about that. What other cuts, if it's known, may be coming for those outlying clinics?
You know, I asked the spokesman for SEARCH, Michael Jenkins, just this morning whether he expected any more cuts. His answer was, we hope not. They're hoping that the changes they've made in this round of cuts with the Bill Brady Healing Center and a couple of other things they've done will be enough to get them through the impact of sequestration. To the smaller communities, to the villages where there are clinics, SEARCH says it should be business as usual. They are, for example, continuing to expand a facility in Hoonah. Kasan is finishing a new clinic. So business as usual is the word from headquarters in Juneau. But on the other hand, there's a training program that SEARCH runs for health aides, the kind of first responders who work at many of those smaller clinics, and they have suspended that program until the end of the fiscal year. So there's a bit of a pause in training new people to work in those smaller communities. Those already in place, of course, will stay put, and many of them don't even work for SEARCH. They're just trained at SEARCH.
You mentioned that you talked to SEARCH officials this morning. There are another round of cuts coming in September. Are they concerned about these fall cuts?
They're hoping not to be. Nobody's making any promises right now. And, you know, what you hear when you ask the questions is we're having a lot of conversations at the board level, at the CEO level. They have just replaced their chief operating officer. As a matter of fact, the previous person left the job a week ago Friday. That would have been April well, I guess late, April 5th, the person left the job. The new person was in place the following Monday, so a very quick transition in the second in command job. And the person they're bringing in is a medical executive consultant, for lack of a better term. And it seems like his resume history is kind of coming into places that are hurting financially, finding ways to help them, and then moving on.
Thank you, Ed. Let's stay on sequestration for a bit. Ellen, sure. You talked to South Central officials yesterday about IHS funding. What were you able to learn about services in South Central Alaska?
Well, I did talk to Dr. Doug Eby. He's the Vice President of Medical Services for South Central, and he said it's sequestration, let's get that clear, is going to hit them hard to the tune of $5 million. And this is money that's already been built into South Central's budget this year. Half of it won't be coming at all. Half of it will actually have to be sent back. And there's two areas where it's going to be instantly felt. And one is with the new Wasilla Clinic, Benta Nuta, which opened only last August. And in 7 months, its visitorship has gone up something 27%, 2,000 more visits since they started in August. And plans to expand services at Benta Nuta are distinctly on hold. And according to Dr. Eby, what is going to happen now is that South Central is looking at changing the way it does business. There will be becoming more of a billing services agency. And he said that it looks like they are going to try to make up some of the losses by encouraging more enrollment of Alaska Natives in Medicare and Medicaid and private insurance programs. And then the bills would be done through South Central. And that's how they would recoup what they're losing now. On the bright side, he felt sure that in next year's budget, there will be adequate money to perhaps move forward with the expansion plans for the Wasilla Clinic.
It's interesting that they're moving more toward private insurance, Medicare, Medicaid. I know that years ago, IHS facilities didn't even have a way by which to take money from other outlets. Does Search also use a lot of private insurance money and Medicaid, Medicare?
They're urging more patients to move that way, for sure. I couldn't give you an exact number about what the percentages are or anything, but I know that I have heard that they're urging patients, if you do have alternate forms of insurance, to bring those up.
Do the officials talk at all, Ellen, when you were in conversation with them, are there any fears about if they move over to more private billing that IHS dollars could be diminished in the future?
Well, as I'm no expert on IHS, but I understand the funding has been flat as costs escalate year after year, and now the funding is actually diminishing. It is the right of Alaska Natives to be enrolled in Medicare, Medicaid, whatever they qualify for. Up to this point, apparently they haven't been because the federal government has taken care of their medical needs. But assuming the way things are going, yeah, they'll be asked for co-pays and billed.
Have South Central Foundation officials, what are they considering to other cuts for making up this shortfall?
Well, I couldn't answer that. This was the main stem of our conversation, that there would be Medicaid and Medicare enrollment encouraged for Natives. And what lies in the future, we don't know. Like I said, Dr. Eby seemed confident that next year they could continue with their plans to expand the Wasilla Clinic. That is pretty much where we are. Comments were focused.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this may impact IHS funding in the future. Let's move on to legislative action now. There was a lot going on last night. I read until late in the night and I couldn't see any longer. We're in the final few days of the session. Greg, editor-at-large of the Alaska Budget Report, there's a plan now to truck North Slope gas to Fairbanks. $355 million finance package is in the mix. What does that pay for?
Well, it pays for liquefaction, construction of liquefaction facilities on the North Slope, and for the capitalization of the transportation infrastructure and the trucks and the distribution or part of the distribution system that regasifies the liquefied natural gas. And the economic studies that underlie it suggest that with that state subsidy, it will definitely bring energy costs in Fairbanks down. It's hoped that it will also make LNG, liquefied natural gas, available along some of the river systems eventually or elsewhere that aren't on the aren't right in Fairbanks or close to Fairbanks. We'll see if that materializes. Of course, it's at the right now, or when it's completed, it won't do a lot for the areas that have the highest energy costs out in western Alaska and in the remote areas.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of how long it will take before there's trucks actually moving gas to Fairbanks?
Lori, I don't, but I can't imagine that it would happen immediately.
The bullet line passed the Senate Finance Committee. There are changes that the House will have to agree to. If the House concurs with the changes, how long will this play out, and what does it mean, if anything, for the prospects on a larger gas line?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that HB4, the legislation that would try to jumpstart the so-called bullet line, a 36-inch line, runs from the North Slope down through Fairbanks to Anchorage or to South Central. And it's hoped that that would make the vast supplies of gas that are now stranded on the North Slope available. But it's not going to be built unless there is some anchor tenant, which is a large consumer such as an LNG export consumer, or they've also mentioned possibility of the Donlin mine, which would, if and when it's built, would use a tremendous amount of energy. Without that anchor tenant, it is unlikely that the line will be economic without major additional subsidies. What's been approved now is basically $400 million to pay for engineering studies and other studies, which are going to be binders on a shelf. And if the economics of the project, when that's concluded, looks good, then we will see those anchor tenants come out of the woods and say, hey, I'm ready to commit to using this capacity. If that doesn't happen, we've spent $400 million to put some binders on a shelf.
Ted Stevens used to say that we would never be able to export gas because it was needed too much in the lower 48. That's changed dramatically in the last few years. What do you think the prospects are for us shipping gas?
Well, I think it turns on several things. Most importantly is the market conditions and the availability of other gas that might be a lot cheaper. Now, how expensive our gas will be if it comes down this 36-inch pipeline will depend a lot on how the pipeline is financed. If there's a huge, it's a $7 billion pipeline, so if the state wants to ante up $7 billion, we can get that gas to Tidewater and be probably pretty competitive. If we have to actually charge the costs of shipping it, including the capital costs, it's going to be tough because prices in the Pacific Basin where we'd be marketing the gas are very competitive right now, and there are a lot of other people who are offering LNG with sources much closer to Tidewater than we are.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing it depends on is federal approvals, and those, who knows what the president or the State Department will say when somebody applies for an additional export permit. Larry Persily, who is the federal pipeline coordinator,
yes.
I think would say privately that it's not at all clear that those approvals would be forthcoming.
Last night there were changes to the oil tax legislation. They're being worked on. It's out of House Finance. This version cuts $3.5 billion over 5 years. I think the last version was around $5 billion or so. The thinking I understand was that this smaller bite would make it more palatable to swing voters. Greg, what does this latest iteration look like, and will it pass now, or do you think there's a special session on the horizon?
Well, I think it was a major move, as you said, on late Thursday evening, early hours of Friday morning. The House Finance Committee reached agreement on a bill that appears to meet the needs that the Senate has to gather its 11 votes and to get for approval. It maintains the 35% base rate, which was a key element, and it, as you say, does reduce the total cost to the state, the benefit to the oil companies by a little bit. Well, we're talking billions here, of course, but. The consensus in Juneau on Friday morning, which was when I last touched base on this, was that it would pass. So I think the chances of a special session are receding, we'll have to, a lot of things can go astray between now and then, and the margin in the Senate when it passed there originally was only 11. They only had the bare minimum votes necessary to pass it. So the supporters are certainly going to keep their fingers crossed and the opponents aren't giving up. But I think it's probably going to come to a vote and probably going to pass.
Can you break down the sort of various layers of the tax structure? I was reading it last night and got a little bit tangled up in the differences between there's a 35% tax rate.
Base tax rate.
There's also a fifth of that will go tax-free on new production. Then there's a $5 per barrel credit. But does this version also allow for changes in taxation rates for rising or falling oil prices or increased production from older producing fields?
Actually, Laura, you summarized the provisions pretty well, and the answer is yes. There is a mild progressivity built into the bill. So when oil prices rise, the percentage tax the producers will pay will rise slightly as well. But it's far, far less progressive than the ACES legislation that was passed under Sarah Palin back in 2007 and that we have now.
Mm-hmm. There was an attempt at a sunset provision earlier. Senator Gary Stevens offered that. It didn't go anywhere. Do you see anything like that coming back to give lawmakers sort of some leverage in several years to say whether this is or is not working?
I don't see that the votes there to do that. Now, as I said, it's the margins are narrow in the Senate, so a change of one individual's perspective could completely overturn all these perspectives. But senators are under a great deal of pressure, and I think that it would be unlikely that that or any other major amendments are going to be approved.
Mm-hmm. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority got some bad news earlier this week about traffic projections, and that sort of led to this cascade effect of now it appears that Kibata will be under the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which was kind of an interesting move. AHFC head Dan Fowsky told lawmakers, look, don't give it to me if you want it to move quickly, because we're not going to move quickly. What does this effectively kill off the Kinnick Arm Bridge proposal?
No, it does not. But it certainly derails it for this year, if not longer. It's very interesting. I think the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, KABATA is what its acronym is, came down to Juneau this year with the view that if they could get Governor Parnell to support their proposed plan to go to bid on the project later this year in a public-private partnership, that they were probably home free and that they could get the legislature to basically sign the check. What they've gotten handed to them, though, is not a blank check with a signature on it, but basically a warrant for their execution as an agency. A remarkable turnaround. And as you say, back up. The critics of the proposal have been very articulate and persuasive, but notwithstanding their well-reasoned questions, the project looked like it was heading for approval until it got to House Finance 2 weeks ago when Mia Costello proposed an amendment that they characterize, the Kabata people characterize as a killer amendment. And then things begin to unravel. And last week on Saturday, when the legislative audit memo came out, or report came out, which indicated that Kabata had overestimated traffic and toll revenues, I think that really shook the confidence of legislators, and it made it clear that if the project was going to stay alive, it was going to have to stay alive under somebody else's aegis, and that's where we are today. So I think that the legislation, as you say, passed the House, and it will probably pass the Senate, and we'll see AHFC probably go back to ground, you know, to the starting point and rework the whole plan, and we'll see what happens next year.
Do you think that in today's fiscal climate, federal dollars are tighter, and probably that's not going to change anytime soon? Are large projects like this just a thing of the past?
No, I don't think so. And in fact, there are quite a few others going forward around the country. And this transportation incentive program has billions and billions of federal money available. Kabata applied for its piece of that little of that pie back in 2007. But you know, relations between the federal government and the Parnell administration have not been the cordialist, and the federal officials who are in charge of this issue say, well, until the state's willing to put some more money into it on its own, we're not going to approve that loan. But the thinking is that the officials aren't too excited about putting more money into what could be known, perhaps unfairly, as another bridge to nowhere.
The operating budget, Democrats aren't happy with cuts and the flat operating budget that's being put out there. They haven't been able to get a lot of traction with legislation this session. The Silver Alert legislation was passed, but other than that, they haven't had a lot of luck getting bills put forward. What kind of cuts do you think we'll see if the operating budget doesn't address inflation?
I think the operating budget is pretty well finished, and it's clear that for the most part, it holds the line, and that means there will be cuts. Particularly, I think we'll see them most immediately in school districts. They have to eat those cost of living increases, the higher fuel costs. There's efforts going on right now. Senator Anna Fairclough and some House people are meeting, or last I heard were meeting, to try to work out some one-time help for education. That's happened in the past, and it looks likely that, or it looks like it could happen again this year. There was a lot of pressure to increase the Educational Foundation program, the state aid program formula, got nowhere basically in either house, and so I think you'll also see impacts in behavioral health, health and social services. They're going to be closing clinics or cutting back in any event. It won't be as quick or as dramatic, perhaps, as a sequestration, but it is definitely going to see squeezes on those services that a lot of people depend on.
Mm-hmm. Ellen, the Mat-Su Burrow budget talks are upcoming. What's on the table?
Well, I talked to Burrow manager John Moosey just yesterday, and he says budgets are in on deadline, a little tight, but not dire. The budget assembly is starting, that will be presented to the budget assembly this week, and the public hearings start the end of the month. It looks like everyone else, the borough is looking to make up some shortfalls. Moosey told me the borough is anticipating about a $2 million less in state revenues, community sharing revenues this year. Also, the borough has taken the step of reducing what they call, it's called a tax on the assets of businesses. They're actually given businesses an increase in their exemption of taxes, so that would result in less money for the borough, and that is to encourage more business establishments within the borough. And there's a reduction in PILT, payment in lieu of taxes on federal land, and put together there could be almost $8 million less coming in this year than they had hoped for. However, the borough is dealing with it, and we will see during the process exactly what happens.
Well, in our final moment here, you've also been covering, Ellen, a proposal for CDQ, Community Development Quota Harbor in Seward.
Yeah.
Which CDQ group is this, and where would it be?
This is the Coastal Villages Region Fund. It's one of the larger of the six CDQ groups. They've got about $250 million in assets. We're talking ships, big ships, Bering Sea, deep sea fishing ships. Right now, those ships are being moored in Ballard in Seattle, and of course, all of the maritime industry needs that go with those ships is being paid out in Ballard. They have been talking with the City of Seward since about 2010 on maybe mooring those ships in a harbor that already exists in Seward, but it needs upgrades, it needs a jetty, like a seawall, and that kind of thing. And it's progressing slowly. Mr. Long told me that they're in no hurry, but it looks like they have money to do what they the design and engineering, and they're fast $17 million out of this year's budget.
Great. Thank you. Thanks. That's all for this week. Thanks to my guests, Greg Erickson, Ellen Lockyer, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. Michael Carey will be back next week. Have a great weekend.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublicmedia.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.